Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Yes, I know financial regulation isn't what you want to talk about on a midsummer's afternoon, but you got to trust me, this is going to be good for you. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau on the broadcast today. Who's going to run it, and what's it going to do? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, monitoring, protecting, and helping improve your online reputation while deleting personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com/market. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and Progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today the 29th of July. Glad you could be with us. It was a hot time at the Treasury Department this afternoon. Seven top banking regulators just sitting around talking. Timothy Geithner hosted. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke and Sheila Bair, the head of the FDIC, were there as well. They were kicking around new ideas about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the one that was created by the financial reform law. The Bureau is going to have broad powers to write and enforce rules on everything from credit card fees to home loans. It's going to have hundreds of employees and a budget somewhere near $500 million. And as always happens when a new bureaucracy is born, a traditional Washington rite of passage is taking place as well. Turf battles. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
The existing regulatory agencies were told today they're going to have to give up some of their staff and budgets. Bureaucracies hate to relinquish either jurisdiction or money, and NYU professor Paul Light says that resentment could easily be a problem for the new Consumer Protection Bureau.
Because you've got old loyalties that you're trying to merge under a new mission. You've got to create a hierarchy. You've got to blend a workforce. There are significant challenges to it.
The financial services industry lobbied hard against the Bureau. The law does give a regulatory oversight council a veto over Consumer Bureau rulings, but that's not enough, according to Tom Quadman at the Chamber of Commerce.
There has to be a two-thirds vote of the council if they find that a rule of the agency will endanger the economy of the United States. That's an awfully high bar.
The restructuring has begun even before the president nominates a director, who George Mason University professor Todd Zwicky says will have unprecedented clout.
With virtually unlimited power, that gives this person the power to regulate virtually every credit transaction in America.
With that kind of sniping, taking charge of the Bureau will be a huge administrative challenge. The leading candidate for the job is the woman who proposed it, Harvard professor Elizabeth Warren. She's been criticized as having an academic focus, lacking administrative experience. But you won't hear that from NYU professor Light.
From my standpoint within academia now, we're just as bureaucratic as any organizations, and so I'm not holding that against her.
The clock is ticking. Congress required that the new agency be up and running within a year. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
There were some new foreclosure numbers out today. Lousy is about the gist of it. But you know, when the housing market first went bust, a lot of people figured it would be good for the rental market. Can't afford to own, the theory went, so you go rent. What really happened was that things were so bad, people didn't rent either. They doubled up with friends or moved back in with mom and dad. Now, though, it looks like people are finally deciding it's time to move out again. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
The big reason people are starting to rent again is jobs. Mark Obrinsky is chief economist at the National Multi-Housing Council. It's a trade association for the apartment industry. He says it's not that the job market has gotten so much better. It's more like people have decided it's not getting worse.
They're less worried about losing a job they currently have than they might have been a year or 2 years ago.
So they feel sure enough about their situation to ditch the roommate or move out of their childhood bedroom. Obrinsky says the fact that new jobs are so hard to find also makes renting more appealing.
A lot of people want to maintain some flexibility because they're willing to change locations to find a good job, and they don't want to be stuck with a mortgage on a house that they can't sell.
The other reason more people are renting is that fewer are buying. all those incentives that were supposed to encourage people to buy have expired. Sam Shandon is chief economist at Real Capital, which is a real estate market research firm. He says now there's one fewer reason to buy a house.
That draw away from rental demand is no longer a significant factor in undermining rental outcomes, and it's helping to stabilize demand in the rental space.
So far, the data on the rental market looks good. One recent report says the number of occupied apartments increased more in the first half of this year than in all of last year. And if you're wondering what this says about the economy, economists say it's a good sign people are confident enough to move out. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
The ability to go into a store without a dime in your pocket and still buy something on your credit card is a great convenience. It is not, though, a free one. The store has to pay a fee to the card company for each transaction, a fee that is usually passed on to us through higher prices. A lot of people who use credit cards get those fees back, in a way, in the form of rewards programs. Those who pay cash, they're just paying. Marketplace's Eve Tro has more now in a new study from the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston.
Credit card companies sell rewards cards hard.
At Citadel, the points pile up faster.
The only charge card that earns triple points on airfare.
Like triple rewards on electronics.
Sean Harper watches these ads closely.
I'm a total rewards card geek. I've stayed in all kinds of awesome hotels all over the world for free.
But Harper also runs a company that helps businesses negotiate the fees they pay each time a customer pulls out plastic. He says those fees can reach 4% of each purchase, and a chunk of that goes to cover the cost of rewards. People who pay cash chip in for people's free miles and cash back.
It's obviously true, just looking around, that rich people use rewards credit cards and poor people pay in cash.
The Federal Reserve Bank of Boston found that affluent card users get about $750 worth of rewards a year. Customers who pay cash subsidize about $20 of that. Ioana Stavins wrote the study. She says businesses should tell customers how much they pay in fees.
It would help them make more informed decisions. It might not necessarily lead to changes in their behavior.
She also says shops should be allowed to charge extra for accepting rewards cards. Right now, that's illegal. But stores can offer discounts for cash, like Green's Beer and Wine in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina.
Crown Royal, regular price is $44.27. Cash discount price, $42.98.
Store director Don Kozlowski says customers who use cash save the store money and deserve to pay less. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
A quick correction from yesterday. By way of setting up a story on the publishing industry, I said Amazon has sold more ebooks in the past quarter than actual books. It was actually hardcover books, should have been. This Thursday on Wall Street is in the books. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The sports scene here in downtown Los Angeles the next couple of days is going to be all skateboards, BMX bikers, and rally car racing. It is X Games time in the hot city. While athletes compete against each other, the companies that sponsor those athletes are competing, too, for fans and their dollars. And they are not doing it in traditional ways because action sports fans and athletes are distinctly non-traditional. Trip Mickle writes about action sports for the Sports Business Journal. Trip, good to have you with us.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Since we're talking about marketing, I suppose it makes sense to begin with the audience. Who is it that watches these action sports?
It's really 12 to 34-year-old males primarily. You know, a lot of these people who gravitate towards these sports tend to set kind of a trend that kind of can run through kind of all of U.S. culture to some degree.
I'm not going to say it's a paradigm, but marketers and companies have found new ways to advertise to these influencers, to this crowd.
This really grew out of kind of a challenge that they tend to be resistant to any kind of brand imagery. You know, they don't want to be smacked in the face with Gatorade talking about how great, you know, a drink it is, you know, in a traditional commercial format. It takes something a little more subtle and a little more creative. For years, videos have been big among people who are skateboarders or BMX riders, and brands basically, you know, took the idea of the video, borrowed it for themselves, and inserted their own product and video, kind of showcasing athletes that they had endorsement deals with.
So give us an example.
A great example would be what Gatorade has done with a BMX pro named Nigel Sylvester. They gave him and a producer about $15,000, way less money than you would ever have to spend on a typical commercial, and said, hey, go shoot kind of a day in the life piece. And the three-part series was titled Go All Day and kind of fit in with Gatorade's Go All Day campaign.
All right, so let's roll that tape, and then we'll talk about it a little bit. Let me set it up. Nigel wakes up. He makes a date to go riding, and then he goes downstairs where he comes across his dad.
Why are you guys? Hold on. Nigel, stop leaving these half-empty bottles in the fridge. It's so annoying.
Nigel hears that from his dad and, of course, goes straight to the fridge, gets the Gatorade bottles out. There's the product placement for you there, and leaves the half bottle in the fridge. But the point being, Trip Mickle, that what you get out of this is some BMX riding on the streets of New York, some fun stuff to watch, and I guess it works.
It got about 180,000 viewers on YouTube and really got some traction. And basically, for all intents and purposes, it's the exact same thing Nigel Sylvester would have done with the same video producer 5-10 years ago. The only difference is there's some support from a corporate brand that is already supporting him with an endorsement deal.
All right, but here's the payoff question, though. Does advertising like this sell as many bottles of Gatorade or Oakley sunglasses as regular branding and advertising do?
When you look at Gatorade, for example, I mean, on a case-by-case basis, you would have to say this is beneficial for them because they've just moved into this kind of world of action sports. I mean, for other companies, it's a great way to launch a brand. You know, if you can create something viral and get people to come to it and pass it around and spend time with it, you know, and create a cool factor and a cool buzz, you know, I think your brand stands a strong chance of kind of either getting off the ground or a new product stands a strong chance of taking off.
Trip Mickle, he covers action sports for the Sports Business Journal. And you can see some of those Nigel Sylvester videos we were talking about on our website. It's marketplace.org. Trip, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Sixteen years after the horrible genocide in Rwanda, the country is slowly putting itself back together. Almost every citizen can get basic health care. You can access the internet in most places. Gross domestic product, that is the economy, is growing steadily, due in part to one slice of the population, women. Lisa Desai reports.
Take a stroll through the capital city of Kigali, and you'll come face to face with today's Rwanda. Roads are paved, tall buildings dot the skyline, and workers sweep the streets clean every morning. These are just a few signs of Rwanda's slow but steady fight against poverty. The government has big hopes to triple the size of the economy in just 10 years.
The status of Rwandans in 16 years has never been better.
That's politician Jean-Darc Mujawamari. She says when the genocide ended, Rwanda was left 70% female. So women picked up the pieces and started to rebuild. Today, in almost every sector of Rwandan life, you'll find a woman.
Because, you know, they are now in business. They are in social development. They are in economic empowerment.
And they're also in leadership roles. Rwanda is the only country in the world where women outnumber men in parliament. Just 10 years ago, women weren't allowed to own land or keep their assets separate from their husbands. Now they can. And Rwanda has a special police unit to stop domestic violence. The government is also trying to draw more women out of the house and into the workforce. All over this very Catholic country, you'll find family planning clinics. At a clinic near Kigali, there's a full house. About 40 women are learning how to use contraceptives and stocking up free of charge. Celine Uwaisiba is waiting to pick up her birth control pills. She doesn't want too many kids. She says she'd rather work and earn an income, just like her husband.
I enjoy being a businesswoman because I can buy whatever I want without bothering my husband. Women also need to prosper and contribute to the school fees of their children.
Notice how she focused on education? Many government officials are convinced that women are more likely than men to invest in the household. Give them some money and they'll buy food, clothes, and tuition. Even the men agree. Dr. Jean Nawakurijajo is a leader in Rwanda's parliament. He says that's how Rwanda will lift itself out of poverty, one strong woman at a time.
The woman is the heart of the family, so the heart of the house. So if your heart is working well, the whole body, I think, is also to benefit.
But there are still challenges. Most Rwandan women can't get loans because of high interest rates and too much red tape. One of those women is Kansilde Kazimoto. She bought 5 acres of land just outside of Kigali for a tomato farm, but she can only make money off half of it. For her business to expand, she'll need a greenhouse, good fertilizer, and technology that's more advanced than a traditional hoe. Kazimoto's lobbying for women to get easier access to loans. She says just a little bit of money could take her business a long way. And she's not afraid to think big.
Why not start a tomato processing industry? Maybe we could turn the tomatoes into ketchup. There is no such thing in Rwanda.
At a busy market in Kigali, Kazimoto tries to sell her tomatoes. Every penny she makes will go back to her family and her business. Kazimoto is determined to see it grow. She compares her tomato business to the women of Rwanda. It's come a long way, she says, and still has a long way to go. In Kigali, Rwanda, I'm Lisa Desai for Marketplace.
You can see the women you just met. We have pictures from Lisa's trip to Rwanda on our website. It is marketplace.org. Coming up, say hello to anti-energy drinks.
Vacation in a bottle, Mary Jane's tea, and dream water.
But first, let's do the numbers. Markets bounce around all day today before taking a final dip. The Dow Industrials gave back 0.3%, 30 points, closed at 10,467. The NASDAQ dropped 0.5%, 12 points, 2251. The S&P 500 slipped 0.4%. That is 4 points, finished at 1,101. Financial firms kind of went both ways. Goldman Sachs shot up more than 3.5% today. Citigroup added 0.75%, but Wells Fargo gave back 1.33%. J.P. Morgan Chase forfeited about 0.25%. Tech stocks were a big part of the market's problems today. Chipmakers NVIDIA and Symantec cut expectations for the next quarter, raising worries about a slowdown. NVIDIA sheared off nearly 10% today. Symantec peeled off more than 11%. Bonds held steady. The yield on the 10-year T-note stayed at 2.99%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, committed to customer service. At allybank.com, visitors can chat online with a customer care associate 24/7. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll find Marketplace, The Morning Report, Marketplace Money, and more, all at marketplace.org.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases its advance estimate gross domestic product report for the second quarter. President Obama visits Chrysler and General Motors plants in Michigan. And Mr. Universe, the Terminator, and 38th Governor of California, Arnold Schwarzenegger, turned 63. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. This has been a tough year so far for Goldman Sachs. There was that fraud lawsuit from the Securities and Exchange Commission, the $500 million check that Goldman had to write to settle that suit, an 83% drop in profits a couple of weeks ago. And now, according to the Wall Street Journal, they're not even allowed to swear about it anymore. The paper says Goldman is telling its employees to stop cussing in emails. Their foul language about some of those fraud-related transactions came back to bite them when Senator Carl Levin gave a public email reading at a hearing a couple of weeks ago.
Look what your sales team was saying about Timberwolf. Boy, that Timberwolf was one deal. They sold that.
Mr. Chairman,
whatever it was, it was a...
Swearing alienates people, gets you in trouble at work, and yet, still, we do it. How come? For that, we've called Jesse Scheidlauer. He's an editor-at-large of the Oxford English Dictionary. Jesse, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Swearing is something that a whole lot of people do, but swearing somehow in the workplace is a little bit different.
People swear all the time, but there are always going to be circumstances where it's not appropriate. In some workplaces, it might be appropriate. It's what everyone does. It's part of the atmosphere. In other places, it might be extremely improper. And you can't make a blanket rule about it because it really depends what the situation is.
Of course, the blanket rule in most places is you can't swear here because somebody's going to be offended.
Saying a rule like that covers up the fact that not all swearing is, in fact, offensive. I mean, sometimes you're saying words just for a sense of camaraderie or just to get along with other people or because the nature of the office is very informal. If you wanted to make a rule like don't insult anyone, you know, that's a kind of different thing. You know, people often confuse the two, but they're not identical.
How does swearing build camaraderie? Help me out with that one.
Well, because it allows you to identify the situation as something where you're trusting people that you can use a kind of language that's less formal or less proper than you normally would do, or to express emotions that might be stronger than what you would normally express. And it's really the same kind of thing as other kinds of social behavior where if you were at a company dinner, like there's a difference between going out for formal dinner or having a picnic, where if you have a picnic and you're eating with your hands, that's showing something about how you're getting along with other people and how you expect them to react to you. And it's the same thing here, I think.
What do you make of this decree from Goldman Sachs that they can't use cuss words in emails anymore?
Well, I think it's a matter of public relations more than anything else. I mean, whether or not you use offensive language, you could say things that could be problematic. And whether you say some stronger version of, you know, this is a crappy deal, or if you said that in a more formal way, it doesn't really matter, but it certainly look worse if you're going to use a slang term because it suggests that you really don't care.
So low quality will become the euphemism for poop?
Well, it might.
One more thing about this, though. We were talking about this story around the conference table this morning, and we got it on to talking about how journalists swear a lot. And somebody said, you know, but that's who we are. Journalists just swear. And I imagine around Goldman they say, you know, we're Wall Street guys, and we're tough, and we just swear. Does that make sense?
There are certainly some professions that are known for swearing a lot. I mean, stereotypically, stevedores, for example. But there are a number of them that do. I mean, yes, journalists will swear a lot, and Wall Street guys will swear a lot, and soldiers will swear a lot, and all sorts of people will swear a lot. Many of these groups probably do think they're somewhat unique in how much they swear.
Is there a lot of cussing around there at the Oxford English Dictionary office?
Not too much, only when we're talking about the words themselves.
Jesse Scheidlauer at the Oxford English Dictionary. His book, by the way, is called The F Word. Jesse, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
There's a pretty regular Starbucks run that leaves the office here around 9:30, 10 o'clock or so every morning. Helps us cope with the all-too-common problem of not enough energy to make it through the morning. You throw coffee in with vending machines offering energy drinks and sodas. You add tea and the occasional chocolate bar. And Americans consume tens of millions of pounds of caffeine every year. The drinks and all are great for keeping us up. But what about when we want to come down? Marketplace's Caitlin Carroll reports they've got drinks for that, too.
After a long day of loading up on caffeine, sometimes the only way to relax is to have a drink. No, not that kind of drink.
Mary Jane's Relaxing Soda is a relaxation drink that has kava in it.
Kava root supposedly relaxes you, like that other kind of Mary Jane. Matt Moody created the drink last year after losing his job at a nutritional supplement company. Moody's drinks are among the more than 20 downer drinks on the market now. Drinks like Vacation in a Bottle, Drank, and Dream Water. They contain supplements such as melatonin, valerian root, or tryptophan. You know, the stuff that knocks you out after Thanksgiving dinner. Gary Hemphill is with the research firm Beverage Marketing Corporation.
Well, what we know is that today's consumers will buy beverages for reasons other than refreshment.
Like to help them stay awake. The market for energy drinks is worth about $4 billion a year. But Hemphill says sales of relaxation drinks are still small. Only around 20 million.
There is an education process with consumers to basically teach them what the product is.
And the high-octane approach of energy drinks like Red Bull and Rockstar isn't really an option.
So we can't drive around in big monster trucks.
Matt Moody from Mary Jane Soda.
We have to drive around in Mini Coopers and stuff like that. Something a little bit quieter.
Consumers are willing to spend to get some sleep. They already drop around $12 billion a year on pills, gadgets, and bedding designed to help them get rest. But do these new drinks work? Hard to know. The FDA doesn't regulate the drink makers' claims. Dr. Alon Avedon is from UCLA's sleep clinic.
We don't know what is being marketed, whether the dose in these drinks is really an effective dose.
So to see if any of these drinks actually induce sleep, I turned to my colleagues at Marketplace. I started with overnight producer Ethan Lindsay.
Jim and Carol.
Do you have 2 minutes?
Yeah.
I tracked Ethan down at the coffee machine, where he spends a lot of his time.
Did you try the relaxation drink? Which one did you have?
The shot, the chill shot, the eye chill.
Did the drink have any noticeable effect?
Before I could even take the eye chill, I fell asleep. But I only slept for 4 hours, so then I woke up again and I said, okay, this is going to put me back in the mood to go to sleep. I saw no noticeable difference and wasn't able to fall asleep.
I felt like I'd had like 3 cocktails.
That's reporter Stacey Vanek Smith. After a shot of eye chill, she slept through her alarm and the morning news meeting.
Yeah, it shouldn't be like eye chill. It's like I don't make any plans or something.
My coworkers also tried out Vacation in a Bottle, Mary Jane's Tea, and Dream Water. The results were all over the place. Avedon from UCLA's sleep clinic says there's a simpler way. Cut the caffeine, don't fall asleep to the TV, and don't take work to bed. In Los Angeles, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering long-term strategies built on experience and research. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, a little bit of cause, effect, and corporate profits for you. As the economy recovers, more companies are going to the debt markets, issuing bonds to get capital to make widgets and whatnot. Those bonds have to be graded by the big ratings agencies, the ones that help the economy get to a place where it needs to recover. More bonds, of course, means more ratings, which means more money for the ratings agencies. Moody's reported quarterly profits today. AAA, you might say, up almost 7% for the quarter. And for us, that's Marketplace from American Public Media this Thursday afternoon. Today, the Dow gave back 0.3%, about 30 points. The NASDAQ down 0.5%, 12 points. The S&P 500 slipped 0.4%, about 4 points. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this show, the business of food in a truck.
We're standing next to the grilled cheese truck now. And when they came to us and they said, look, we have this gourmet grilled cheese concept, my partner Morris said, I love it. Let's get you on the road.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.